wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. Portland listener-supported is democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Denise Morris is the producer of today's program. We at the Old Mole are dedicated to offering a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and LGBTQ positive analysis of culture, politics, and current events. We're about halfway through our spring fundraising drive. If you like the radical critique the Old Mole provides, as well as the other excellent public affairs programs you can hear only on this station, please consider making a donation today. You can become a KBOO supporter by going to kboo.fm/give. You can also mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland 97214. Today in our program, Lori Mercier interviews Sue Palmater about an upcoming climate justice Q&A with Oregon's state treasurer. I'll be sharing an article from the Soapbox webpage entitled "The Root Cause of Central American Migration is Broken U.S. Policies" by Felipe de la Hoz. Denise Morris interviews Old Mole Jan Hawken, director of Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance, about a panel coming up on May 6th titled "Climate Resistance, Art, Action, and Allyship." Further details on how to participate in the above events will follow later. You will need a paper and pencil to jot down the information. Now Bill Resnick talks to Paul Fenn, who drafted the legislation now in effect in Massachusetts, Iowa, California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, and Virginia. Collectively, they serve about 5% of Americans in over 1,300 municipalities. These enactments authorize communities to take over the electricity supply responsibility from the local investor-owned utility, or IOU. Bill and Paul also discuss how community energy agencies operate on a day-to-day basis and why, though under attack now by the IOUs, they are still expanding because of their many virtues, offering more reliable, less expensive, and greener sun and wind energy to the cities.
Hi, Paul Fenn. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Paul Fenn is one of the most important people. He's made significant contributions to all of us who inhabit the planet. But he's one of the most important people you never heard of because he was the thinker and doer, the innovator, who brought to life first in Massachusetts in 1995, and then around the country brought to life one of the most important innovations of the 20th century. For Paul Fenn, at age 25, drafted the legislation that authorized community energy. In Massachusetts, the legislation is called Community Choice Aggregation, as it is in California. But whatever the name, these enactments authorize the creation of public community agencies with the power to replace the corporate utilities in serving the electricity needs of their community, and to replace it with mostly clean, green, sun and wind technologies. The many existing community energy cities in Massachusetts, over 150 cities, including Boston, who have just begun, they are proving to be the quickest and least expensive means of ending the grave, in fact, existential threat of man-made climate change. In addition, community energy creates the possibility of a far more healthy, democratic, sustainable, more fulfilling societies for all its members. That's a big claim. We're going to prove it. So, Paul Fenn, tell us the story of the legislation, how you came to draft it in Massachusetts, and why the time was right for it.
I was, a guy caught in a situation. I was in graduate school in early 90s, and I happened to have a friend who told me about his professor, who, it turns out, became famous for the economic theories behind basically carbon trading, the idea of carbon trading. That is the idea that we can reduce carbon by trading permits to pollute. And this is the dominant kind of policy paradigm of U.S. climate policy. Really, since then, this professor, his name is Ronald Coase, a British economist, had come up with a theory in the 1950s I thought it was just such a horrifying notion, because I was studying intellectual history and specifically propaganda, Nazism, things like that. And so the idea of carbon credits to me were reminiscent of that kind of abuse of language that you would say as a matter of policy, that we will sell the right to pollute the atmosphere and then we'll allow the owners of those rights to trade them. And that struck me as just utterly dystopian. So I confronted this professor in a humorous way, and he supported me, and in fact, he told me that I was right, and that his theory, which was kind of old by then, was wrong, and it was all going to be worked out in the restructuring of the energy industry, and that this was going to be coming up to the United States. So he knew all these things. He was still a professor at the University of Chicago in the Department of Economics, and I knew nothing about any of these things, nor did I care about them, frankly. But I thought, here's an opportunity. He said it would start in Massachusetts and then move to California. Well, I'm from California, and my wife is from Massachusetts. And at the time, her uncle, actually her step-uncle, was the governor of Massachusetts. And in fact, he just left. And so I thought, I have to do something about this. It was really just this seeing the opportunity that I could jump into early phase of the discussion about climate policy in this, what Ronald Coase, this economist, said was the central arena for working out what he called the relationship between the government and marketplace. So I was very interested in studying the crises of capitalism and communism, and I was very interested in the possibility of other economic theories, and really was viewing climate change as a really good test case for an economic theory. And then electric industry restructuring became this very targeted, specific opportunity to try to articulate something. So I used my connections to get a position in the Massachusetts Senate. I was the director of the Senate Energy Committee, the Senate half of a joint committee on energy and the state legislature, and which put me in charge of writing the legislation for the committee. And little known to anyone, really, I was putting together this idea because it wasn't really desired by anyone. There was no one asking for this bill. In fact, most were opposed to the idea because there were other ideas that were in circulation, namely the sort of Enron idea of just deregulate everything versus the old monopoly idea, which is let us keep controlling everything. And this was very much a third course for which there was no existing constituency. So at first it just seemed like a wild dash by a graduate student to throw something in the mix, really thinking of it more as an act of literature than as anything that would succeed. So I was very surprised to find, ultimately, when it did become law in Massachusetts, I laughed. I couldn't believe it.
Somebody must have promoted it in the legislature. What was going on at the time in 1995 where a majority of the legislature would vote for a law that gave communities the power to take over from the investor-owned utilities? How is it that it, in fact, passed the legislature and was enacted around the country in several states? In fact, I think you were central to that.
Yeah, I was. I worked on it, well, since then, right? But, in fact, I still work on legislation now in states that are thinking about it. I've written bills for a number of states. But, yeah, it's a really interesting story and something I'd love to tell people because it's one of the main insights or lessons, I guess, for me, of having gone through it, was realizing this fact that I don't think is widely enough realized, because we live in this very top-down political system where we view ourselves as having no power, and we participate in national elections with this hope that we'll get a great leader who will somehow change everything for us. The story of community choice aggregation, when it passed in the Cape, what we thought at the time was, because we were surprised ourselves, but to realize that municipalities as governments have a kind of quiet power in state legislatures. It's quiet because they're not as omnipresent as the energy companies, which have these permanent armies of lawyers that are always at the legislature and they know everyone and totally connected and often have been in and out of the government themselves. Municipalities are quieter. They just send their lawyer to a legislative hearing who makes usually a fairly blasé statement of policy by the municipality. But what we learned was when you get enough of those in a legislative hearing room, basically if you have more city attorneys in the room than you have utility attorneys, you win. Because they do have this upwardly projecting kind of centrifugal power, where the power of the local reaches up into the state and federal levels, specifically because the local politicians are colleagues of the state legislative members.
Sure. Yeah,
and they compete with them and they're allied with them. Exactly. And if they get mad at them, then they run against them. And so they don't want to fight. And so if there's enough local governments appearing, and particularly what I learned was local governments in the jurisdictions of the committee members, for example, of the Energy Committee, of the affected committee in the legislature, that's very persuasive to the voting behavior of a committee.
How did you convince the city attorneys and the mayors, apparently, or the city managers, that this wacky idea, basically having the city take over the energy supply, how did you convince them of that, especially since the big utilities have so many lawyers and lobbyists and make charitable contributions in every city trying to curry support? How did you manage to get all these city attorneys on your side?
That is really another really interesting question, and which I will attempt to answer. I think it's the next layer, right? There's the one layer, which is the power of that the local has once it's expressed at the state level, which is in many ways profound. The second is, you know, how do you get that city attorney to appear? I have never persuaded a city attorney of anything because they can't be persuaded by a member of the public, right? And nor have I ever really persuaded a city council member of very much, because local elected officials, as well as state, tend to be the extroverted types that don't really follow rational reasoning. So, other than the rational counting of things like contributions and votes and so on, but not what's a good idea, we should do that good idea. That's almost never happened to me in my career, almost never. There's never that level of attention given to ideas in politics. And so it's really just a seduction process is how I like to describe it. It sounds a little exotic, but it has to do with how do you convince someone that something is a good idea without them having to commit anything in advance? And the answer is, first ask them, do you think you should be allowed to do this? Not do you think you should become a community choice aggregator, but do you think you should be allowed to become a community choice aggregator? That's a really easy question to answer yes to. And that's really what I asked. And so I prepared resolutions for city councils to adopt where they said they should be allowed to. They didn't say that they were going to do it. And when I first got those resolutions adopted, they're very easy to get adopted because they don't commit anything. Resolutions are essentially statements of opinion. But what they do importantly is they give you a document to bring to the state legislators from those districts to convince them to pay attention to you. And so now someone who would never listen to an idea wants to know what you're doing because they're getting pressure from their competitors. It's that kind of math that really drives the bargain. And so the city attorneys appear downstream. Now, here's how it works, really, in my experience, is I get that resolution, which was easy to get because you just need someone to sponsor it and it doesn't commit anything. Local governments love to adopt a resolution that doesn't commit action. So it's really easy. It takes about 2 weeks to a month to pass a resolution. And then so I would get, you know, a dozen of those or so. In Massachusetts, we actually got 30. And in California, I got, I don't know what it was, 40 or something resolutions, and brought them to the legislature with the bill and found a sponsor because of the resolutions, basically. Now, what happened immediately when you get a sponsor in the legislature is the sponsor begins to be lobbied by the utilities to gut the bill. And so there commences a process where the sponsor should be sharing with you these requests to gut. And of course, when they're shared with you, you then share them with the municipal officials that pass the resolution. So they learn that the utilities are now maneuvering to prevent them from having the right to do what they said they should have a right to do. And now you've engaged a public official in an issue that they care about for the first time. Because when someone tries to block a politician, that is a personal offense. And so for the first time, really, at that moment, they want to become CCAs. It's like the Tom Sawyer trick with the white fence on a certain level.
They also respond, it seems to me, politicians, to sort of the zeitgeist, the way the people are coming to think, to the values that are being expressed. And my guess is that your resolutions had to be supported by community people and seen as a way of getting out from under the very expensive and sort of authoritarian corporate model and corporate control. My guess is, at least in Massachusetts and California at that time, the people did not oppose it. My guess is that it seemed like something that should be tried. I think partly because of the unpopularity of the Enron model, especially then.
Yes, Enron, the Enron crisis created a permanent opening for CCA around the turn of the century. Up until that time, it was different because public opinion was basically asleep on the subject of climate and energy in the 1990s. But the crisis, as well as obviously the climate crisis slowly coming onto public opinion, have changed that. And the battles that occurred also helped. So the utilities in California tried to block the local governments from doing these things. And those battles became very front page news for a number of years. And that raised consciousness as well. But I think there is an important idea there that you mentioned, that particularly with climate change, but also with a lot of ecological epiphanies of our time, there's a lot more, in a sense, people are ahead in their thinking of the government. The government is sort of backward. The governing class is more backward. So the people are more radical than the government on the subject of climate change. And activism was a major part of CCA. I mean, the reason that we could get all these people in the room was that activists were working on it to get these resolutions, and they could see the angle. So it was a very compelling idea for people who had been trapped in conventional energy policy, which are things like how to get cheaper power for consumers and more energy efficiency and more renewable energy, but not the kinds of ideas that now are in circulation, such as climate emergency, right? So thinking is changing a lot, and the government's being dragged along in that process. But activists are what made this happen.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to Paul Fenn. He wrote the legislation that brought community energy to birth in 1995 in Massachusetts. He's fought for community energy ever since. Paul Fenn, the big corporate utilities, as we discussed, are very powerful, supported even by the banking industry, who make great sums underwriting the corporate utility debt and their bond offering. They've made great efforts to stop cities and states from creating community choice laws. We'll hear from you next week, Monday, on This Old Mole Show in part two of our interview. Yet with all the IOU money and effort, community choice keeps growing in the states where they are authorized. And communities, cities, in some cases counties, particularly in California, groups of counties, they fight to keep them. The utilities are constantly trying to destroy them in the public utility commissions of the state and the legislature, too. In California and other states, they've run initiative campaigns, which have usually lost, although the IOUs have, in fact, captured some legislatures who have limited community energy or destroyed it. But the cities themselves who have it, my sense is that people support them and protect them and don't want to return to be served by the corporate utilities. Tell us, why is that? What are the virtues of community energy that maintain support for it?
It is really the core of the economy, and it is to climate change what the suburban mall is to global labor exploitation, right? It is the syringe of the global energy system. And so control over the energy sectors, electricity, natural gas, gasoline, diesel, constitutes really the whole driver of the globalizing system that we've lived in since World War II, specifically an American system. So it's very much sort of locked and loaded with the post-war order, so-called. And in some ways, you know, with the end of the Cold War, the base of that order disappeared. The need to have, the perceived need to have the military-industrial complex disappeared, and yet it didn't go away. And the energy industry that is essentially its handmaiden didn't go away either. All of these oil ships that follow the same naval highways as the military ships and all the supply chains that the military protects at sea, that's really two halves of one system. So I do think that there is a desire to disengage from that system by people and recognizing that always putting your money into the Shell or Chevron pump every day and putting your money into the fossil utility every month is a big part of the problem. And so trying to figure out how do you change this energy system, and in some ways it is a kind of, because we have state regulation of monopolies as the main market structure in the United States, again, post-war establishment system of a tight marriage of large corporations and government, it's a bit of a protection racket where the state regulators claim that they're trying to achieve all these sorts of benefits to deal with climate change and protect consumers and so on. But they're sort of like the priests with the conquistadors who try to protect the Indians while converting them. And so it's getting out of that protection racket, I think, is very appealing to a lot of Americans, just breaking out of the system. On the other hand, the Enron solution to the breakout, deregulation, essentially release them to the wolves, right? So they recognize that we need something other than just deregulation. And so the municipality comes into view as this really quite traditional principle of communities protecting their interests. I think it's non-controversial among the political parties for that reason, that it's not a centralized structure, it's a decentralized structure, and it gives autonomy and self-governance to communities, which also, in a sense, is non-controversial, even though some would call it radical. It's not really controversial. And that form of local authority over utilities, over public needs, it is very traditional. But specifically in the context of climate and energy, people do want meaningful climate action that they're not getting from state governments or the federal government, and they've never received it. But they also want protection from the energy market itself, because with climate change and with peak everything, there are these recurring cyclical crises in the energy sector that are extremely damaging to local economies and to local safety. And so there is increasingly a desire to get greater local control over energy and have less exposure to, for example, the price of gas, like what just happened in Texas, to have these insane shocks to the economy that occur because of a storm. That's all caused by overdependence on gas, for example, right? And most Americans are overdependent on gas. So when gas markets become unstable, you suddenly have energy bills that double, triple, and all of the energy sectors are hedged off of each other as a financial instrument. So you have basically the tracking of different energy commodities, and they all go up and down in relation to that volatility. So desire to solve climate change, desire to get some independence from the volatility of the energy market, disengage from the main cause of war worldwide. So all those three, I think, really motivate the transition to an energy democracy idea that is widely spoken of now, energy democracy. And I don't think people really know what they mean by that, but I think they know what they mean is that it should be local, that people should be able to be more participatory in their decisions about energy, not just receive multiple choice options from corporations and government. And that we need to have creativity and innovation, and we need to adapt to local needs and not just get cookie-cutter energy products from Corporation A, Corporation B.
Paul Finn, it seems to me it's also a bread-and-butter issue that is, if community energy was a lot more expensive than going through the corporation, it seems to me that people would, because most people in the United States are strapped and energy bills actually add up, they would be much more interested in the investor-owned utilities, their efforts to, the people could be organized against the community energy. But my sense is now that in almost every case, and in California, the community energy people have shown themselves to be much cheaper, and they also, unlike the investor-owned utilities who talk about sun and wind and their commitment to it, but in fact, they don't care if they're doing oil or sun and wind, but they just don't want to strand their coal and gas assets. It's just they can't be paying the bonds on plants that are closed and not producing. So they at best can go very slowly towards removing their coal plants and gas plants and all the rest of it. And also because there are tremendous costs involved with the IOUs, particularly in the grid, building the grid and the whole apparatus. My sense is that the bread and butter issues are also important.
Definitely. That's the real driver, you know, that these community choice aggregations have uniformly saved consumers money and small consumers, and whether residential or businesses that in other markets don't receive benefits. So that's been really driven the growth of CCA to whatever it is now, 30 million Americans, because it saves people money. But what has really made the policy grow at an even faster rate recently is the idea that you could turn, not just pay less for your energy as a benefit to consumers, but that you could convert your monthly electric bill into equity, that you could repurpose the bill you pay every month for electricity and for heating, and even for your cars, for your gasoline. By changing technologies, you could turn those into assets that essentially that you own, so that you're no longer in this sort of renter class in relation to really the main bill that you pay, right? The energy bills being the first bills that people pay in society because they just have to have that energy. It's the driving force. So the opportunity to no longer be just a consumer of energy, but to have local renewables and at the neighborhood level and even have it at the building level and normalize that as an idea and energy, a different way of thinking about energy, a different way of relating to it economically. I think that's really what's driving the growth now, sort of from saving money on that, you know, percentage of discount per month, you know, 20 years ago to now the opportunity to not have energy bills someday, right, which is what happens when you put solar on the roof and you pay it off. Once it's paid off, then you don't have a bill. And that's wealth. That's a change from reducing poverty to creating wealth.
Well, friend, my sense is that community energy is popular and cities and the people in cities do not want to give it up because the community energy entities, the local entities, can work with groups on the ground who are seeking an alternative transport system, alternative agriculture, alternative city form. There's really a sort of a change of consciousness happening in the United States. And my sense is that the entities who provide the energy in working with the transport people and the urban agriculture people and the people who urge energy conservation and use reduction, that in fact is an enormous plus for community energy because they can build those cultures where we're using a lot less and doing it a lot more cheaply and in fact getting healthier because we're not getting the various kinds of pollution that fossil fuels create. I don't think we have time to talk about that, but maybe next week we can. Paul Finn, our apostle to renewable, clean, sun and wind energy, local community energy. It was great to talk to you, and we'll continue next week.
Thank you, Bill. It's an honor. I truly enjoyed it.
Keep up the good work.
Song, I'll Bet You Never Guess, was Power to the People by the Plastic Ono Band. The song in this case signifying electrical power to local communities. Now Lori Mercier speaks with Sue Palmiter, who is co-leading the Defend Divest team with 350 PDX, about an upcoming climate justice Q&A with Oregon State Treasurer on Wednesday, May 5th at 7 p.m. The State Treasury invests $118 billion, mostly PERS monies, with a portion of that invested in fossil fuel companies contributing to the climate crisis. Find out how Oregon can invest in a more sustainable future. For more information about the Climate Justice event with State Treasurer Tobias Reed, and to register and for resources on how to take action, go to https://350pdx.org/action. That's https://350pdx.org/action/.
I'm speaking with Sue Palmiter, who is co-leading the Defund Divest team with 350 PDX, about an upcoming climate justice Q&A with Oregon's state treasurer this coming Wednesday, May 5th. Thanks for joining us today, Sue, on KBOO to talk about this important event.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for helping your audience learn more about the treasurer's responsibility in terms of the climate crisis.
Well, tell us why 350 and dozens of other groups have organized this meeting with Oregon State Treasurer Tobias Reed.
Right. The treasurer or comptroller in other states is responsible for investing the state funds. In Oregon, there's $118 billion in state funds currently. About $80 billion of that, that's with a B again, is PERS money. And they have the fiduciary responsibility to invest it for their beneficiaries. And what we're learning is that the Oregon funds are invested, some of them, in fossil fuel infrastructure, new developments, Arctic drilling, offshore drilling, you know, fracking, things that I think most Oregonians would really be opposed to. And so we're just trying to connect the dots between the treasurer, an elected official in the state, and the climate crisis and what he and the Oregon Investment Council can do to invest our money wisely, prudently, and morally.
So this divestment movement is happening in other states. And earlier you were telling me about New York has recently divested their $226 billion pension fund from fossil fuels. So is this part of this effort in Oregon? And is this something that's an action that's happening in other states as well?
Right. So New York State, the comptroller there, Stringer, has really taken the lead. But other states are also moving towards the divestment in fossil fuels. New York was the first state pension fund to divest from tar sands companies, and they're going to move forward with other types of fossil fuel companies. Yeah, we're hoping that this is the beginning of a discussion with our Oregon Treasury about how the pension funds are invested and wanting to exit coal. Our state is invested in coal, probably to over $100 million, not a whole lot, but still there's just no way coal is a good investment along with all the fossil fuels. So we are working with others around the country in different states like Massachusetts, California, Illinois, that are trying to move their state treasury to divest. We have had some success with the treasurer in voting the shares that they have. So they can also vote at annual general meetings of publicly traded corporations. And they can vote boards of directors or vote for or against resolutions that have impact on climate. And he did vote the Oregon shares last year in 2020 for J.P. Morgan Chase, for one of the board members who was the biggest climate denier probably in the country, Lee Raymond, who was on the J.P. Morgan Chase board. And he voted our Oregon shares to vote him off. And in the end, it was successful, and Lee Raymond is no longer on the J.P. Morgan Chase board. So, you know, our treasurer has shown some interest in moving in that direction by his votes in more of an engagement model, saying we're going to still invest, but we will vote those shares. And we're really moving towards joining other states like New York to divest completely.
So in addition to removing Oregon taxpayer investments from fossil fuels, then the state treasurer and I understand the Oregon Investment Council, which the treasurer leads, can actually influence corporate behavior, as you described, by getting together with other state treasurers to vote to have Lee Raymond, former CEO of Exxon, removed from the board of J.P. Morgan Chase. So are there other ways that, I mean, 350 is trying to mobilize people within states to stop the money pipeline from financial institutions to more rapidly combat the climate crisis? I know that you've put out the Stop the Pipeline shareholder season information on your website.
So anyone that's interested, we have links that you can learn more at the 350pdx.org/actions, and you can learn about this action as well as the background material about what state treasurers can do. But when you put all the state treasury monies together for the whole country, we're talking $4 trillion. So it's a huge opportunity to motivate these institutional investors to use that money wisely. Number one, because we have a huge climate crisis on our hands. But number two, it's a fiduciary responsibility. These fossil fuel companies are losing money, and it's not good fiscal responsibility to continue to invest in them. They have to start transitioning. And the states that wait the longest are going to have the most loss in their investments. It's really both of those. And then when you start multiplying it to that $4 trillion amount, we at 350 are working with the Stop the Money Pipeline Coalition, which is a coalition of about 150 Greens around the country that are working together to really follow the money. There are different levers that we can use to fight the climate crisis. One is legislative, like the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, the what's going on in the Oregon legislature there with healthy homes and so forth. Then there's the regulatory things. You can try to block permits, like the Jordan Cove blocking of permits, which was successful. And then there's the financial piece of it, and that's what the Stop the Money Pipeline Coalition is working on that we're very involved with. And that's looking at asset managers, banks like JPMorgan Chase, the largest funder of fossil fuels in the world, and insurance companies who insure these projects and also invest in them. And then there are these institutional investors like the treasurers around the country. And that's just a huge opportunity to really start looking at how we can leverage that piece. So we're all about follow the money, and we feel like that's how decisions end up getting made. And so that's why we're doing this laser focus on our state treasury and our state treasurer on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. He will be there to talk to us, but we'll be having stakeholders that are going to ask questions, and folks like the president of the SEIU, who's one of our co-sponsors, to teachers who are invested in PERS, to young people who are really concerned about their future and how our state is investing in that future.
And it sounds like this kind of mobilization at the state and local level can have immediate impact. I mean, just from the example that you described from last year, last May, about this kind of grassroots or pressure on Treasurer Reed led to his willingness to vote Lee Raymond off the board of JPMorgan Chase. Mm-hmm. Do you and 350 and others see this direction of mobilizing within states as a real avenue to more quickly trying to halt the fossil fuel and fuels chain and combating the climate crisis?
That is what we will probably be looking at moving forward, is to be in coalition with our other 350s throughout the state, down in Eugene, Deschutes, Salem, and so forth. And then, other Greens in the area like the Sierra Club and Sunrise and XR, along with church groups like First Unitarian and all the Indivisibles in the state and others that have come alongside us with this event. We'll see what the next steps are. We'll see if the treasurer really hears our demands and our asks of really telling us what they're investing. We have yet to really understand how the money is invested and how much of it is in fossil fuels. It's not transparent at all. And so we're trying to just get that information. We're trying to continue to ask the treasurer to pressure corporations to move towards sustainability. And then, see how Oregon can make their way to ending these investments that aren't making clear, verifiable progress. Clearly, we've heard from him that it's very difficult, and we understand that, but clearly New York State is figuring it out. And if New York State, with their vast treasury, can figure it out, then we feel Oregon, can too. Yeah.
Right, right. Well, Sue Palmiter, tell us again about this meeting on Wednesday, the details, how folks can register, and any other details you think we should pass on.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much, Lori. Yeah, it's May 5th. That's Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. And this is the Climate Justice Q&A with Treasurer Tobias Reed. And you can get the registration link and a lot more information at 350pdx.org/action. So that's 350pdx.org/action. And there'll be lots of information about what we're going to be doing at the Q&A with the treasurer, along with how it all works, how our Treasury works, how Treasurer Reed works with the Oregon Investment Council, and how he is an elected official and responsible to beneficiaries and to the state. So really appreciate taking the time today to have your listeners understand this important issue in our state.
Yeah, well, thanks, Sue, for all your work and PDX's, 350's work on this event. And we will post on the Old Mole website, on the KABU website, the links to Wednesday's event. Thanks again.
Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. All progressives know that the increase in migrants arriving at the U.S. border are fleeing intolerable conditions in their home countries and deserving of our compassion and support. These intolerable conditions, we are told, are the root cause of this migration. But that is only the surface cause. The real cause lies deeper. Today I'm sharing an article from the Soapbox webpage entitled "The Root Cause of Central American Migration is Broken U.S. Policies" by Felipe Duoz. Migrants are fleeing their home countries in large part because of the conditions that the United States helped bring about. There's an interesting turn of phrase, the article begins, that comes to dominate the Biden administration's rhetoric around immigration, root causes. The idea of root causes isn't inherently sinister. There are, after all, discrete, identifiable, and systematic issues driving people to uproot their lives and travel to the United States seeking economic and physical safety, these days mostly from the so-called Northern Triangle of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. While often discussed as if emerging from a vacuum, the state of weakness, corruption, inequality, and domination of organized crime that so often forms the basis of asylum seekers' claims has been created and fomented at every turn by U.S. policymaking. Starting with the Cold War era, covert and overt military intervention and regime change, and continuing through the exporting of gangs like MS-13, originally established in California, through harsh, short-sighted immigration enforcement during the Law and Order late 80s and 90s, there's almost no socio-political economic issue plaguing these countries that doesn't have U.S. fingerprints all over it. The primary root cause of humanitarian migration from Central America is the U.S. government. Of course, these people have also been failed by their own leaders, who have often chosen to save themselves and perpetuate the structural issues that are making the ship go down. But that doesn't mean that we didn't shoot the torpedoes. Yet liberals and conservatives alike are in complete lockstep most of the way, only diverging on very narrow questions about just how cruel it's acceptable to be to desperate migrants and to what extent it's okay to violate federal and international law by turning them away to danger. Pundits and commentators of every stripe have spent the last several weeks pushing Biden to essentially seal off the border to asylum seekers without acknowledging that that Trump holdover policy rests on shaky legal ground. In the near term, it might be viable for U.S. foreign aid to alleviate some of the pressures driving people away from their homes, especially given that, contrary to domestic popular belief, many asylum seekers would have preferred to stay if it had been safe to do so. But we must disabuse ourselves of the idea that this is a path to avoiding asylum flows at all. The U.S. refugee program has historically been pretty robust, though currently in a bad state. But it takes years of applications, checks, and processing for people to actually make it into the country. The administration now appears to be trying to expand the program in Central America in the hopes that if and when other measures aren't enough, migrants will stay out of sight and out of mind for the American public until they're ready to resettle instead of showing up at the border. Still, for people under imminent threat, particularly those able to reach the U.S. border, the clear choice is to make the trek, perilous and uncertain as it may be. And even as Biden tries to reduce these threats in Central America, he'll have to face the looming risk that is set to soon become the primary driver of humanitarian migration, climate change. The unfolding disaster is already driving some refugees from Latin America and the Caribbean, with several countries recently experiencing high-intensity hurricanes, droughts, crop failures, and rising sea levels. What we've seen so far is only a taste of the massive climate migrations to come, and like the political and security instability the U.S. has instigated, it is again primarily responsible for this catastrophe and its consequences, while being best insulated from its fallout. Even as Biden takes some aggressive steps to combat climate change, some of the impact is at this point unavoidable. For millions of people in Central and South America and around the world, climate crisis will make their lives untenable, and they will have to leave. Yet unlike people escaping state repression or violence, climate migrants won't have even the nominal legal protections guaranteed by the current asylum process, which typically requires the former, and which are already often interpreted to exclude those escaping gang violence and economic destitution. Will the U.S. stay firmly entrenched in the notion of humanitarian migration as a nuisance, an unfortunate conundrum detached from our own direct responsibility? Or will we acknowledge that receiving asylum seekers is not only a legal responsibility, but a moral one, and an atonement for our excesses and short-sightedness? The pressure will always be there to separate cause and effect for the public and our leaders to complain that we can't accommodate everyone, as if it were a favor and they held no accountability. There's still time to consider these questions before the next upswing in arrivals and before the more dramatic effects of climate change, but not that much time. When we find ourselves yet again watching wall-to-wall coverage of the border, will the crisis be that people are still arriving, or will it be that we have washed our hands of their plight? I've been reading from an article entitled "The Root Cause of Central American Migration is Broken U.S. Policies" by Felipe Dua Oz, and it's from the Soapbox webpage. Felipe Dua Oz is an investigative reporter focusing on immigration.
The crops are all in and the beaches are rotting. The oranges are back in the creosote dumps. They're flying and back to the Mexico border. They paid all their money to wade back again. Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus and Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All ever call you will be deportees.
Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, Deportee, or How the U.S. Mistreats the Very Migrant Workers That We Are So Dependent Upon. Concluding our program today, Denise Morris interviews Old Mole Jan Hawken, Director of Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance, about a panel coming up on May 6th titled Climate Resistance, Art, Action, and Allyship.
Good morning, Jan. We're here this morning on the Old Mole to talk about an upcoming event on May 6th titled Climate Resistance, Art, Action, and Allyship. This is related to your work with the Necessity films, Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance, Part 1, and the upcoming Part 2 film. The panel will be hosted by Portland State University and includes Oregon-based artists, activists, and an attorney who bring their wisdom and knowledge to the Necessity Film Project, which again is a two-part documentary that features Indigenous leadership in responding to the climate crisis. Jan, let's start with the title of this event, Climate Resistance, Art, Action, and Allyship. Can you talk about how these parts go together?
Well, I love alliterations. Beyond that, I think there's a side of effective social movements that's sometimes called cultural work that is often unrecognized and unappreciated. The aesthetic side of social movements, the way beauty, joy, and gratifying production of a vision of the world and a vision of a better world are part of also the educational organizing parts of social movement. So as an academic, I moved into filmmaking partly thinking of it as a form of art. And when it's done well, I think people have the right to expect a satisfying cultural or aesthetic experience when they watch a film, even a film about a daunting topic like the climate emergency. And with this panel, we have a number of people who are really working on the creative side of activism, both the Sunrise Movement. Susie Kassoff will be there talking about the role of joy and pleasure and creativity in climate resistance. Activists who We're at the center of a trial that'll be featured in Necessity Part 2, a trial of activists who occupied the site at Zenith, and we're part of using the necessity defense at trial last year, and that trial will be central to Part 2 of the film. And that also involved a very creative use of an action of sitting on railroad tracks at Zenith, one of the most dangerous polluters in the region, Zenith Energy in Portland, a big oil terminal storage facility. But the action included use of art and images, the planting of a garden that were meant to kind of prefigure a different vision of the community and of a sustainable future. With our panel on May 6th, attendees will get a sneak preview of some of the art in the film itself, created by Asa Wright, who's a member of the Klamath tribes and someone who's been very involved in art and the design aspects of decolonization and social change movements and radicalism. He's an incredibly gifted artist, and he created animated art to accompany a story included in the film. And the story was written by Umatilla storyteller Esther Motonic, who was a beloved storyteller with the Umatilla Confederated Tribes, who died some years back. She wrote a story called The Monster Who Came Up the River. And in the film, it's narrated by Don Sampson, who's the chief of the Walla Walla tribe. And we use this story and the art to represent both the power of Native storytelling, but the metaphorical way you can use visual storytelling as well to represent a horrific problem, the climate crisis, but also build a sense of vision and hope and imaginative capacity for a different world. So in all of the film projects that my team and I, the team that has been working on this and I've taken up, we try to draw on indigenous imagery in our map making using iconic images from indigenous communities whose stories are included in the film, to give a feeling for the region and the cultural language of the locale, as well as the broad global crisis we're all facing.
Well, Jan, we'll have certainly plenty of opportunity to talk more about the film itself as it evolves and is completed, a process that is generally not easy, and I applaud your continued dedication to making documentary film,
you
and your team. But let's let people know then the details about how they can participate in the panel and where to go to find the film Necessity Part 1 to view, and what that all looks like for May 6th.
Part 1 is completed but not yet in distribution, although hundreds of teachers have shown it through the Zen Education Project, and they're able to show up for free in their classroom, and we've had over 200 requests for the last 6 months for teachers to show the film, and as a film that students like to watch because it educates on the history of civil disobedience, the role of legal strategies and indigenous leadership in the movement, but it's also a hopeful film and an inspiring film. So attendees who register through Eventbrite, and they can learn about how to register through our website, necessitythemovie.com, or our Facebook event page at Necessity the Movie. But attendees can, when they register through Eventbrite, they can give any amount they can to support this project, and then they get a link to watch Part 1, which is not yet available to video on demand. And then they also will get a link to join the panel on May 6th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. and to learn more about these incredible people who are part of either featured or the creative process of Necessity Part 2, which is set in the Columbia River Gorge and also features indigenous leadership in climate resistance and the fight against fossil fuel transport and terminals in the region, and includes, in addition to Asa Wright and Susie Kassab, who I mentioned, it includes co-director of the film, Sam Prowse. It also includes Durell Kalika, who's a tribal attorney on the faculty at Portland State, and activist and retired social worker, Kathy Santacruza. And we see some of the work she's done in blocking a megalode some time back and carrying tar sands pipes up through tribal lands. And I hope that in watching part one and also joining the panel this week, people will not only support this project, but learn from these inspiring and committed activists and want to join the struggle, including a focus we have on the role of civil disobedience and nonviolent direct action in the climate movement.
Sounds amazing, Jan, and we'll definitely have links to this information on the Old Mole website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, and we'll look forward to watching the film and to the panel. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Denise.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Denise Morris produced today's program. Thanks to all our regulars and their guests, Bill Resnick and Paul Fan on community-owned and operated electrical grids, Lori Mercier and Sue Palmiter on the upcoming climate Q&A with Oregon's state treasurer, and Denise Morris and Jan Hawken, also about an upcoming climate resistance event. Please remember it's our spring pledge drive. KBOO has the most diverse selection of music programs that covers everyone's musical preferences. That alone is worth supporting. Become a KBOO supporter, go to kboo.fm/give. You can also mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We argue for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles to chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. Tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This is KBOO Portland.